I told him if he ever spoke to me like that again, I'd reach down his throat and pull out his testicles one at a time, Joey said. I've got a temper, okay? Stranahan promised to keep that in mind. So that night we're lying in bed, Joey said, and Chaz says he's sorry for blowing a gasket. This while he's trying to climb on top of me. Tells me he won a big settlement from being in a car accident. When? Long time ago, before we met. He got T-boned by some drunk Kiwanian up in Tampa and seriously screwed up his back. Said he was on crutches for, like, 6 months. And you're married almost 2 whole years before he mentions this traumatic, life-altering event, Stranahan mused. Maybe he thought... I don't know. Joey shook her head. Maybe he was embarrassed because he got the money from a lawsuit. I'm sure. Probably wanted you to think he'd won a Nobel Prize, or maybe a MacArthur Grant. She was feeling more foolish than ever. In other words, assume everything your husband ever told you was bullshit, Stranahan said. How much would you guess that new Hummer cost? Nearly 60 grand, with all the bells and whistles. I checked on the internet. They heard a yelp and turned around. Strom was floundering miserably in the basin under a swill of teasing seabirds. Stranahan calmly jumped in the water and gathered the big dog in his arms. Joey hurried to fetch a towel. Later, while the fish was frying, Stranahan opened a bottle of wine. "Don't worry," he told Joey. "It's from California, not France." "So this isn't one of your smooth bachelor moves. Give me a little credit." "But isn't that Neil Young we're listening to?" "With Buffalo Springfield, that's right. You're pretty darn sharp for a youngster." Stranahan filled her wine glass. "How about tomorrow we get off this rock?"
"Good idea. Wait till you see that Hummer," Joey said.
"What I'd really like to see," said Stranahan, "is anyone on a state salary who can pay cash for a $60,000 set of wheels." The petty officer's name was Yancey. "Here's what I was talking about," she said. The 4 bales were laid out in a row on the floor of an empty holding cell. The sodden weed gave off a strong, sickly sweet smell. Yancey was pointing at the 3rd bale. Carl Rolvog crouched to get a closer look.
"Weird, huh?"
the petty officer said. The wrapping was damaged in 2 places. Rolvog carefully probed at the puckered fabric with the cap tip of a ballpoint pen. Each area was characterized by a series of slender longitudinal furrows, several of which were deep enough to have punctured the burlap. "Can I ask a favor?" the detective motioned Yancey forward. The petty officer did as she was asked, Rolvog lifting her left hand and placing it over one of the divots in the bale. Then he took her right hand and covered the other. The alignment was nearly perfect, each of Yancey's fingers matching a rumpled groove in the cloth. "How about that?" Rolvog said. Yancey went rigid.
"Sir, it wasn't me. You have my word," she said. "This is what it looked like when we found it."
"Relax," the detective said. "I believe you."
"You asked us to report anything unusual that we saw or found," she said. "Anything out of the ordinary is what you said."
"Yes, and this is very helpful. I can't thank you enough."
"We're glad to be of assistance, sir."
"And whereabouts was this one found?"
"Angelfish Creek," Yancey said.
"No kidding. That's a long haul."
It meant that Joey Perrone had gone in the water long before her husband said she did.
"I need 2 small favors, Rolvog told Yancey. "You ordinarily burn the grass you confiscate, isn't that right?"
"Yes, sir. We turn all contraband over to the Federal Task Force. They incinerate it," the petty officer said.
"This bale here, tell them not to," Rolvog said. "Mark it as evidence and put it in a safe place."
"Evidence?"
"Yes, sir."
"Also, have you got a pair of tweezers and a baggie?"
"Let me check the first aid station," Yancey said. While she was gone, Rolvog sat down on one of the other bales and blew his nose fiercely. He was afflicted with numerous crop and pollen allergies,
and wed marijuana rated a code 10. The word Libertad had been scratched on a wall of the cell, and the detective wondered who had done it and where the poor bastard had been deported. As much as Rolvag disliked South Florida, it was useful to be reminded that there were infinitely worse places not so far away, places that made Hialeah look like the Emerald City of Oz. Petty Officer Yancey returned with the requested items. Using the tweezers, Rolvag began meticulously exploring each of the finger grooves on the burlap sacking. It didn't take long to dig out the clue he was hoping for.
"Could you open the plastic bag?" he asked Yancey.
"Yes, sir. What did you find?"
The detective held it up, pinched firmly in the beak of the tweezers for her to see.
"Is that the tip of a fingernail?" she asked.
"It would appear so. A woman's, I'm almost sure."
"So she was trying to rip open the bale. Is that what happened?"
"No." Rolvag dropped the nail fragment into the baggie. "She was hanging on for dear life." As Petty Officer Yancey studied the clawings in the fabric, Rolvag thought he saw her shiver.
"Sir, was this the woman? Could these marks be from the woman we were trying to locate? The one missing off the cruise ship?"
The detective said it was possible.
"Weird," Yancey said quietly. "Spooky weird."
"Yes, it is." Rolvag turned back to the soggy bale. "Let's see if there's more." 7. The development was called West Boca Dunes Phase 2.
"Dunes," said Mick Stranahan. "We're 15 miles from the beach."
"Chaz tried to buy into Phase 1 because it's on a golf course," Joey Perrone explained. "But they were sold out."
"Every house looks the same."
"Oh, they're identical. All 307 units in our modern Florida subdivision," Joey said in a mock sales pitch voice, "except that some feature the master bedroom suite on the east side and some have it on the west. Also, you can get a pool."
Stranahan lowered the binoculars.
"But you don't have one,"
Joey said. "Chaz hates to swim."
"Not you. That was your big college sport, right?"
"Ancient history," she said.
"Still, it would have been nice for you, a swimming pool."
"Yeah, well,
how about another fig?" Stranahan asked.
They'd stopped at an outdoor market in Pompano Beach, and he had loaded up on fresh produce. Now the car smelled like 2 tons of Mediterranean fruit salad. Joey Perrone said,
"It's lucky you got that island thing going for you, Mick, because this," she patted the dashboard, "ain't exactly a pussy magnet."
"Excuse me?"
"That's a Chaz-ism for a hot car," Stranahan said.
"The Cordoba is an automotive classic. You'll be pleased to know that your butt is sitting on rich Corinthian leather."
"Maybe once upon a time."
For years, Stranahan had kept the rusty car under a shady ficus tree near the Dinner Key Marina, where he docked the skiff when visiting the mainland. Nothing on the Chrysler worked properly anymore except the enormous engine, which ran like a miracle. Joey said,
"We sit here much longer, somebody will definitely call the police."
Mick Stranahan conceded that the Cordoba didn't blend in with the late model SUVs gleaming in the parallel driveways of West Boca Dunes Phase 2. Joey told him to get busy while she found a place to hide the car.
"I might need to break a window," he said.
"There's a spare key and a bird feeder in the backyard."
"About an alarm?"
"Broken. See you in 10 minutes.
Stranahan wore a short-sleeved work shirt from Florida Power and Light and a white hard hat. He went up to the front door and rang the bell. After a minute, he circled to the rear of the house and pretended to examine the electric meter until he figured even the nosiest of Joey's neighbors would have lost interest. The bird feeder was hung in the only tree in the Perrone's yard, a scrawny black olive. The key was covered with grackle droppings, which Stranahan wiped on the grass. As soon as he entered the house, he scrubbed his hands and put on a pair of rubber kitchen gloves. He was waiting by the front door when Joey knocked.
"So, what do you think of my new look?"
I'm there, Stranahan said. She wore a cropped brunette wig and a gray knee-length house dress, and she carried a worn Bible. All of it came from a thrift shop they'd found down the street from the produce market. Stranahan motioned her inside and shut the door. Her shoulders stiffened, and she stood in the foyer for several moments without saying a word. He took her by the elbow and said, It's all right. Is there anything I shouldn't see? I haven't taken the grand tour, but this was on the kitchen counter. It was a section of the Sun Sentinel that had been unfolded to an inside page. Joey read the headline aloud. Coast Guard calls off search for missing cruise passenger. Oh, my God, there I am. Local woman feared drowned. Do you believe this? She dropped the Bible and seized the newspaper with both hands. I knew it, Mick. He's saying I got drunk and fell overboard. That's not in the story. No, but it's the obvious implication. Perrone told police that he and his wife had shared several bottles of wine earlier in the evening. The couple had been celebrating their second wedding anniversary. The prick! Joey crumpled the newspaper and slam-dunked it into the trash can. I'm calling Rose, she said. Who's that? My best friend. She's in our book club. Mick Stranahan waited in the living room, trying to figure out who had decorated the place. The sofa and two reading chairs were comfortable and smart-looking, probably Joey's touch. Chaz's contributions would be the plasma TV and the jet-black Natuzzi recliner. The tragic aquarium could go either way. Stranahan was struck by the absence of books and the abundance of golf magazines. No family photographs were on display, not even a wedding picture. Joey stalked into the room carrying a cold beer in each hand. She gave one bottle to Stranahan. Rose almost had a seizure. She thought I was calling from the grave. Speaking of which, what's that awful smell? The aquarium, I'm afraid. Joey groaned as she approached the tank. That frigging idiot forgot to feed the fish. They looked like shiny little holiday ornaments bobbing in the clouded water. Joey turned away in angry disgust. Stranahan followed her through the house, room by room. Nothing more was said until they reached the master bath. Oh, cute. My stuff's gone. Everything? My toothpaste, makeup... Joey tore through the drawers and cabinets, all my lotions and creams, even the tampons. This is unbelievable. She hurried to the bedroom and flung open the closet door and let out a cry. My clothes, too! Stranahan opened the top drawer of an antique bureau. Undies, he reported, perhaps too brightly. These he saved. Asshole! Joey slammed the closet door so violently that it came off the track. Stranahan said, Personally, I advocate cunning and stealth over mass destruction. He righted the door and set it back in place. Joey grabbed her bra and panties out of the bureau and sat down stiffly on the edge of the bed. I'm going to cry now, okay? And I don't want to hear a word from you. Not one damn word. Crying is allowed. Go right ahead. And don't you dare put your arms around me and stroke my hair and give me all that wise, fatherly, brotherly bullshit. Not unless I tell you to. Fair enough, Stranahan said. This was my house, Mick. My life. And he's just sweeping me out the door like I was dirt. She closed her eyes and oddly found herself thinking of the night that Chaz had begged to tie her to the bedposts. He had chosen Alsatian scarves, but had cinched the knot so tightly that her fingers and toes immediately went to sleep. It had been one of those rare times with Chaz that she'd had to fake it. But what made the night more memorable was that he'd passed out on top of her in a creepy sexual stupor. For nearly an hour he had lain there, snoring between her breasts and drooling like a Saint Bernard, yet remaining solidly erect inside her. Joey had felt as helpless as a butterfly pinned to a corkboard. Upon reflection, she realized that the bizarre interlude had been a telling lesson about her husband. Conscious or unconscious, he was completely dick-driven. "The guy's an animal, and I never saw it," she said disconsolately.
A primitive with a Ph.D., and I was a fool for marrying him.
Joey? Stranahan was standing at the bedroom door, spinning his hard hat in his hands.
Yeah?
If you're going to cry, then cry. We need to be moving along.
Give me 5 minutes alone.
You got it, Stranahan said.
5 minutes. Then come back and put your arms around me and tell me everything's going to be okay. All that cornball crap.
You sure?
Yeah, let's give it a shot. But first, take off those ridiculous gloves.
Later, they found the rest of her belongings crammed in 3 cardboard boxes stacked in the garage next to her Toyota. As Joey began sorting through the depressing inventory, Stranahan warned her that Chaz might become suspicious if items disappeared.
And don't even think about taking your car, he added.
Glumly, she held up a pale orange handbag.
This is what I brought on the cruise.
Chaz had obviously overlooked her wallet, which contained $650 and an American Express card.
The plastic I'm keeping, she informed Stranahan. We'll need it.
The cash, too.
Come here and dig in, Joey pointed to one of the other boxes.
May I ask what we're looking for?
Something saucy, she said. Something to catch the eye of my worthless troglodyte husband.
Dawn brought a thunderstorm and the screeching of rats. Karl Rolvag's pythons had awakened hungry. For 10 minutes the detective stood under a cold shower, a ritual meant to thicken his blood in preparation for the return to Minnesota. Rolvag believed that living in South Florida had turned him into a weather wimp. Captain Gallo had told him to take the day off as comp time, but Rolvag had nothing else to do but work. By the time he'd shaved and dressed, the snakes were finished, and Mrs. Schulman was pounding on the door. She lived across the hall in Unit 7G and held the title of Acting Vice President for the Sawgrass Grove Condominium Association. Her current mission was to evict Karl Rolvag from the premises.
"Good morning, Nellie," he said.
"I heard it! That god-awful screaming again, you sick bastard!"
"They've got to eat," the detective said, "same as you and me."
"If you weren't a cop, they'd throw you in jail for animal cruelty."
Mrs. Schulman, who weighed at least 90 pounds, acted as if she intended to punch Rolvag in the chest. Her bony, mottled fists were clenched and trembling. The detective said, "The Condo Association paid how much for rodent extermination last year? 3 or 4 grand, wasn't it?" Mrs. Schulman sneered.
"Don't get snide with me."
"There's nothing in the rules says I can't keep reptiles."
"Dangerous pets. It's right on page 119.
"Your dog's bitten 4 people, Rolvag pointed out. "My snakes haven't hurt anybody."
"Disturbing the peace, then. Those helpless mice screaming and moaning while God's breath is strangled out of them. It's horrible. I had to double up on my Xanax, thanks to you."
"They're big fat rats, Nellie, not Stuart Little. And by the way, that poison your exterminator uses, it makes their little tummies explode."
Mrs. Schulman wailed, backpedaling. "Why don't we leave this to the lawyers," Rolvag said.
"You're a sick, sick, sick bastard. No wonder you're not married anymore."
"And no wonder your husband went deaf."
Somewhere in the parchment fissures of Mrs. Schulman's face, her eyes narrowed.
"You'll be gone by July, smartass."
"Keep Petunia on her leash," Rolvag advised, "and you've got nothing to worry about."
After a late breakfast, he drove to the office and showed Captain Gallo the letter from the police chief in Minnesota.
"Very humorous," Gallo said. "Where the fuck is Edina?"
"Twin Cities area." "Didn't they write a song about it? Nothing could be finer than to be in your Edina in the morning."
Rolvag said, "I'm serious about taking the job."
"Cut it out.
I want to live somewhere normal."
"And die of fucking boredom, I'm sure you do."
Gallo handed him a scrap of paper.
"Guy named Corbett Wheeler called. That's his number."
"Mrs. Perrone's brother." 1:30 in the morning, kangaroo time, he's wide awake, Gallo said. Wants to talk to someone ASAP. Says it's important. Rolvag had been trying to locate Corbett Wheeler since Saturday afternoon.
I'll call right now, the detective said.
Make it collect.
You're kidding.
Gallo shrugged.
That's what the guy said. Be sure and call collect.
Somewhere in the hills of New Zealand, Joey Perrone's brother picked up on the first ring. Carl Rolvag half expected him to sound like the flaky Aussie who wrestles crocodiles on TV, but Corbett Wheeler hadn't lost his flat American accent.
Are you the one in charge of the case? He asked.
That's right, Rolvag said.
Then listen up. My little sister did not get drunk and fall off that cruise ship, Corbett Wheeler declared. No matter what her husband told you, and she didn't take a dive either.
The connection was fuzzy, and Rolvag heard his own voice reverberate when he spoke.
I understand this must be hard for you. Would you mind a few questions?
It was in the Boca newspaper. That's how I found out. A friend of Joey's called to tell me.
Rolvag said, We've been trying to get a hold of you since Saturday. Your brother-in-law gave me a couple of phone numbers, but they were no good.
Just like my brother-in-law, Corbett Wheeler said. He's a fuckwit and a reprobate.
When's the last time you saw him?
Never met the man, or even spoke to him. But Joey's given me an earful. I wouldn't trust the guy alone with my bowling ball. That's what a horn dog he is.
Rolvag had heard similar opinions from Joey's friends, though none of them hinted that Charles Perrone was deeply involved with anybody but Charles Perrone.
You're suggesting that Chaz had something to do with your sister's disappearance.
Bet the farm on it, said Corbett Wheeler.
It's a long way from adultery to homicide.
From what Joey told me, he's capable of anything.
Rolvag heard sheep lowing in the background.
Maybe we should talk in person, he suggested.
Honestly, I don't travel much, said Mrs. Perrone's brother, but I'd fly all night to see that little whorehopper strapped into the electric chair and lit up like Dodger Stadium.
These days, most of them opt for lethal injection.
Are you telling me they get a choice?
I'm afraid so, Rolvag told him.
What's that noise?
One of my ewes, trying to pop triplets.
Can I call you back?
No, I'll call you, said Joey Perrone's brother, and the line went dead.
Fuckwit, reprobate, horn dog, whorehopper, an impressive litany of contempt for Chaz Perrone.
Rolvag reported Corbett Wheeler's suspicions to Captain Gallo, who shrugged and said,
Hey, nobody wants to believe the little sister was a clumsy lush. Did he know about the DUI?
I didn't ask. Rolvag could name plenty of friends who'd been busted for drunk driving, and not one had ever fallen off a cruise ship.
What if Wheeler's right about Perrone?
Then you'll figure it out, too, and make us all look like geniuses, said Gallo.
Hopefully by Friday. Rolvag knew better than to mention the nail marks on the marijuana bale until the DNA testing was complete. The procedure wasn't inexpensive, and the captain would be miffed that Rolvag had ordered it without his approval.
Gallo handed him the letter from the Edina police chief. Rolvag folded it back into the envelope.
Is 3 weeks enough time? He asked.
Didn't you hear what I just said? Friday, Carl, and then we move on.
I'm not talking about this case, said the detective. I'm giving my notice.
Is 3 weeks enough?
Gallo sat back and grinned.
Yeah, whatever. I'll play along.
Chaz Perrone parked his Hummer on the levee, a half mile from the spillway. He kept the AC running and slurped coffee as he stared blankly across miles and miles of Everglades. A breeze fluffed the sawgrass and combed ripples in the dark water. Coots tiptoed through the hyacinths and lilies. A young heron speared minnows in the shallows, and a small bass went airborne to take a dragonfly. The place was thrumming with wildlife, and Chaz Perrone was miserable. Nothing about nature awed, soothed, or humbled him, not the solitude or the mythic vastness or the primordial ebb and flow, To Chaz, it was all hot, buggy, funky-smelling, and treacherous. He would have been so much happier on the driving range at Eagle Trace. Red Hammernut was the one who had insisted that Chaz stick to the program, in case Chaz's supervisors at the Water Management District decided to check up on him. It was also Red who'd bought him the Humvee, after Chaz had griped for months that the dirt roads were tearing up the shocks on his mid-size Chevy. Chaz had chosen bright yellow for the Hummer on the theory that such an intrusive color would freak out any panthers that might be lurking in the sector of the Everglades to which he was assigned. Chaz was terrified of being ambushed by one of the big cats, despite the fact that no such attack on humans had ever been recorded. Furthermore, the animals were nearly extinct, perhaps only 60 or 70 remaining in the wild. When a fellow biologist reminded Chaz that the odds of being mauled by a Florida panther were roughly the same as being struck by a meteorite, Chaz announced that he was taking no chances. When informed that the cats were colorblind and would therefore be oblivious to the blinding hues of his Humvee, Chaz wasn't entirely disappointed. Girls seemed to go for the yellow. He climbed out of the driver's seat and was promptly engulfed by mosquitoes. Grunting and flailing, he struggled to insert himself into the heavy rubber waders that he'd purchased from a high-end hunting catalog. The commotion spooked a turtle off a rock, the splash causing Chaz to spin around and glare at the telltale rings on the surface. When he was 7, his mother had presented him with a baby dime store terrapin, which he'd named Timmy, and later flushed down the toilet in disapproval of its casual potty habits. As he sloshed reluctantly into the marsh, Chaz wasn't worried about a turtle attack, as turtles had no teeth. What he dreaded were the alligators, brazen and plentiful. Not a single scientist had been devoured or even maimed by a gator while working in the Everglades, but Chaz believed it was only a matter of time. He would have carried a high-caliber rifle, except that it was strictly forbidden, and he couldn't risk getting fired, demoted, or transferred from the sampling sites. That would ruin everything, including his profitable association with Red Hammernut. Consequently, Chaz's sole instrument of defense was a boron-shafted two-iron, which in his hands was far more efficient at scaring off aquatic reptiles than striking a golf ball. Chaz swung the club haphazardly and yowled like a hemorrhoidal bobcat as he hacked a soggy trail through the sawgrass. Nature recoiled as he threshed the water, launching clumps of algae and splintered twigs and shredded lily pads. In the cumbersome waders, Chaz clomped and teetered like the Frankenstein monster, but the desired effect was achieved. Every living vertebrate within 100 yards of the dike fled the scene. Only the mosquitoes and horseflies lingered to harass Chaz Perrone, and their impassive humming was all he heard when he finally reached the pond where the first monitoring station stood. Otherwise, the swamp had gone mute and lifeless, which was how Chaz preferred it. He stood at the edge of the deeper water, catching his breath, and waiting for the wavelets he'd made to subside. Here Chaz was required to immerse up to his armpits, surrendering what little mobility he had. The stiff rubber leggings that protected him so reliably from the razor-sharp sawgrass and lethal moccasin fangs were not designed for swimming, and would in fact fill up and drag him down like an anchor if Chaz wasn't careful. So he waited for the water to calm, intently scanning the surface for ominous, log-like snouts. In his nightmares, this is where the gators always nailed him, in the pond, because he was exposed and helpless, a sitting duck. On more than one occasion, Chaz had retreated in a blind froth from the monitoring station, certain he was being pursued by one or more of the flesh-eating saurians. Today, the only specimen to be seen was a vividly banded newborn that would have fit easily in a shoebox. Chaz bravely stepped forward and wailed away with the two-iron, failing as usual to land a blow. As soon as the baby alligator was gone, Chaz made his move. Wielding the golf club over his head, he skated his feet heavily across the muddy bottom. He was prepared to clobber anything that came to the surface, no matter how small or harmless, but nothing rose to challenge him. Along the way, he diligently paused to uproot several fresh sprouts of cattails, a small act of tidiness that Chaz believed was crucial to his future wealth and comfort. It took only 3 minutes to remove a water sample from the monitoring station. Chaz made it look good, even though he was fairly certain that nobody from the district was within 30 miles of the site. Red Hammernut said they sometimes sent up helicopters to spy on the biologists in the field. But privately, Chaz was doubtful. He acted out the charade of sample collecting only because it was Red's wish, and Red was the last person on Earth Chaz wanted to cross. Following his freshly cut path, he crashed and howled his way back to the levee without incident. After placing the quart-sized container upright in the back of the Hummer, he kicked and wriggled out of his waders, which stunk of sweat and ripe muck. He grabbed a mango-flavored Gatorade from the cooler and sat on the bumper, the two-iron propped within lunging distance. With a dirty shirt sleeve, Chaz mopped the perspiration from his brow, thinking, "What a steaming shithole this is. To think that the taxpayers of America are spending $8 billion to save it." Suckers, Chaz thought, if they only knew. With the binoculars, he checked in both directions along the rutted embankment. No other vehicles were visible. He squinted up at the sky and saw the omnipresent buzzards, circling clockwise, but no choppers or planes. Satisfied, Charles Regis Perrone finished off the Gatorade and lobbed the bottle into the sawgrass. Then he unscrewed the lid from the sample jar and poured the tea-colored water into the dirt at his feet. River of grass, my ass, he thought. 8. Chaz was sitting in the bathtub, scrubbing off the swamp grime, when Rika showed up.
"Are you nuts?" he said.
"Nope. Just lonely," she stepped out of her oxblood heels.
"Did anybody see you drive up? Where'd you park?"
Rika unfastened her hoop earrings and set them next to Chaz's stick deodorant on the vanity.
"What are you so jumpy about? I thought you'd be happy to see me."
In a moment she was out of her clothes, straddling him imperiously.
"But I'm not finished," Chaz said.
"Damn right you're not."
Rika placed her palms against his chest and pushed. Chaz took a quick breath, squeezing his eyes closed as he submerged. Being a clean freak, he was concerned about the health risks of rough sex and dirty bathwater. Who knew what pernicious tropical microbes had hitched a ride back from the Everglades? It was too late to protest. He felt like he'd been thrown into a blender with a live coyote. The bare tile amplified Rika's feral yips and howls to soul-chilling decibels, the racket seeming louder every time Chaz came up for air. Meanwhile, she was pounding against him with such zest as to generate a seismic rhythm of concussive smacks. Chaz feared that his eardrums might blow out underwater. With both arms, he helmeted himself, not only to save his hearing, but to prevent his skull from cracking against the brass drain plate. Rika was as speedy as she was rambunctious, and Chaz was confident that he could outlast her, providing he didn't drown. True to form, she was done in less than 4 minutes. Chaz disentangled and stork-stepped out of the bathtub, which by then was nearly empty. He grabbed a couple of towels and began mopping up the floor and the walls.
"You're something else," Rika gasped.
She was splayed in the tub like a broken doll, one foot hooked on the soap tray and the other braced against the spigot. Jet-black hair fell in a dripping tangle across half her face.
"My God, Chaz, that was fantastic,"
he said.
"Yeah, you damn near killed me."
"Hey, you're still hard. What's the matter?"
"Not a thing." He snatched a robe off the hook on the door.
"Didn't you come?"
"Sure I did," he lied. "All over the place."
"So that means," Rika pointing, "you're ready to go again? Already?"
He shrugged. "Let's get some dinner."
"You are seriously amazing."
She stood up and wrung out her hair.
"Want a BJ or something?"
Chaz peered quizzically at her crotch.
"What did you do to yourself?"
"It's a shamrock. You like it?" a shamrock he hadn't noticed earlier. "For good luck," Rika explained. "I wanted four leaves, but I only had enough pubes for three."
Chaz was trying to remember if she was Irish.
"It took, like, an hour to do. With two mirrors," she added.
"And they make green hair dye these days?"
"You bet."
"Well, I'm impressed," Chaz said.
"Then we're even.
Come here. Let me take care of that."
Chaz was unnerved to realize that he wasn't in the mood. He glanced down at himself and wondered, "What the hell's the matter with me?"
"I think I heard the phone," he said, and hurried to get dressed. A few minutes later, Rika found him slouched on a corner of the bed. He wore one brown sock and a misbuttoned shirt, and he was staring dully into an open closet.
"What's wrong?"
she asked, touching his shoulder. He shook her off dismissively.
"Baby, I was thinking," she said. "Are you going to have a service for Joey? You probably should."
"I hate funerals. Besides, there's no body to bury."
Rika said, "A memorial service, I mean. They do it all the time for people who get burnt up in plane crashes or when a ship sinks and everybody's lost at sea."
Chaz insisted there was no point. "Joey's only family is some hermit brother who lives on the other side of the world."
"What about her friends?"
"So I'll put a notice in the paper. They can make donations to the World Wildlife Mission. Save the endangered yaks or whatever."
Rika smoothed her skirt and sat beside him on the bed. "What happens next? I guess you've got to have her declared legally, you know."
"Dead?"
"Right." "Christ, Rika, it's only been a few days. Eventually, I mean."
"There's no rush," Chaz said. That damn Detective Rolvag would be scrutinizing him for a while. Chaz didn't want to appear in a hurry to be single.
"How long, then?" Rika asked. "What's the difference? I'm not getting any of her money anyway," he said. "The fucking yaks can wait." "Well, suppose I can't."
Chaz pretended not to hear. He approached the closet and focused once more upon the sheer black dress. It was scooped in the front and featured a racy slit up one side. He took it out and showed Rika.
"Did you bring this with you tonight? Because Joey had one just like it. I mean, identical."
Rika was peeved.
"It's not mine, Chaz. Not unless I've grown 3 inches taller and dropped 10 pounds. "Oh, come on. It's not mine." "Okay, okay."
He yanked the dress off the hanger, rolled it up, and tossed it in a corner.
"I swear I packed that away yesterday."
Rika glanced uneasily around the room.
"To be honest, this is kind of freaky, being in the house with your wife dead."
"What? It was easier when she was alive?"
"No, it's just very sad. What happened to her?"
Rika said.
"Can we get out of here?"
Chaz went to the dresser and pawed through the drawers one by one. He couldn't find Joey's panties and bra, the ones he'd meant to save for Rika. He wondered if he was cracking up.
"Looking for your other sock? It's right there on the floor under the nightstand."
"So it is," said Chaz. "Thanks." As soon as Rika went to fix her makeup, he slipped out the kitchen door and into the garage. The cardboard boxes containing Joey's belongings were exactly where he'd left them, piled next to the Camry. The boxes didn't appear to have been touched, causing Chaz to think that he had somehow forgotten to collect his wife's black dress. As for the missing undergarments, perhaps he'd moved them to another place. In the living room, he was gratified to see that the stinking dead fish had not rematerialized in his aquarium since he'd flushed them down the toilet. Chaz made himself a drink and began scanning the alphabetized by artist CD rack, looking for some kick-ass driving music. What he found while thumbing through the T's gave him a chill. Bad to the Bone was missing. So was Move It On Over. Even the anthology was gone. Rika appeared, looking spectacular but troubled. She said,
"I hope you don't mind. I borrowed some of Joey's lipstick."
Chaz felt the hairs prickle on his neck.
That's impossible. I left mine in the car. I'm sorry.
You don't understand. I threw out all her lipstick, he said. I went through the whole goddamn bathroom and tossed out every goddamn thing of hers.
But it was right there, Chaz, in the vanity.
No, not possible.
Chaz felt a bloom of cold sweat under his arms. He stalked up to Rika, grabbed her chin, and turned her mouth toward the light so that he could examine the color.
Shit, he muttered.
It was definitely Coral Tees, Joey's favorite. His favorite, actually. Just like that slitted black dress, the one she'd worn at his request to Mark's on Los Olas for their first anniversary. He let go of Rika's face and said, "Something's fucked up around here."
"Would I lie about lipstick?"
Rubbing her jaw, she was bewildered and angry.
"You're right. I'm sorry," he said.
"Can we get out of here? Like, now?"
"Absolutely," Chaz told her. "Right after I make a call."
"Swell. I'll be in the bathroom."
She shut the door forcefully behind her and fumed for a minute.
"Where's your razor?"
she called out, but Chaz was already on the phone. Joey Perrone and Mick Stranahan were watching the house from a neighbor's driveway halfway down the block. Joey said it was safe because the neighbors had gone to upstate New York for a month and possibly longer. Dodging subpoenas, she explained. They'd run a telephone boiler room selling ethanol futures to senior citizens. Every time the feds shut them down, they dash off to their lodge in the Adirondacks.
"It's a great country," Stranahan said.
"What are you doing?"
"Trying to figure out the damn CD player."
For surveillance purposes, Joey had rented them a dark green Suburban with tinted windows. She said, "Mick, please don't." He was sorting through the George Thorogood discs that Joey had swept from her husband's collection.
"What? You don't like the slide guitar?"
"I don't like the memories," she said. Joey meant to drop the subject, but then she heard herself saying, "We'd be going along in the car, and whenever he put on Bad to the Bone, that was the signal he wanted me to, you know."
"Gotcha."
Stranahan tossed the CDs into the back seat. "So he imagines himself a wit, Mr. Charles Perrone, and a sex machine to boot." Joey recited the 10 things that Chaz disliked most about her, with hiding Thorogood being number 6.
"That's not why he tried to kill you, believe me," Stranahan said.
"See, this is what's driving me crazy," she said. "I can't figure out why he would do what he did."
"Money's my guess."
"But I told you he's not getting a dime if I'm dead."
Stranahan fiddled with the radio dials. "Most murders come down to lust, anger, or greed," he said. "From what you've told me about your husband, I'm betting on greed. If this isn't about your money, then it's about somebody else's." Joey said that, in a way, she hoped he was right.
"I'd hate to think he threw me off that ship just so he could be with her."
She shot a glare toward the house.
"Not likely," said Stranahan.
"I wish you could have met Benny, my first husband. He was a sweetheart," she said fondly. "Not exactly a firecracker in certain departments, but a good, honest guy."
Stranahan aimed the binoculars at the bay window of the Perrone residence. The lights had come on, though the curtains remained closed.
It had been an hour since the dark-haired woman had arrived, parking a blue Ford Compact next to Chaz's Humvee.
"You don't know who she is?"
"No idea." "It's pitiful," Joey said. "He's got so many bimbos, you'd need radio collars to track them all." Stranahan secretly was pleased that Chaz Perrone was entertaining female company only 3 tender days into widowhood. Such a boggling lack of self-restraint could open a world of squalid opportunities for someone seeking to mess with Chaz's head.
"Let's call it a night," Stranahan suggested.
"Honestly, did she look that smoking hot to you?"
"The longer we stay, the riskier it gets."
"This is what the Secret Service drives, Chevy Suburbans."
"Joey, we're not the Secret Service."
I'm supposed to be retired, and you're supposed to be deceased.
Hey, we should copy the license off her car.
Done. Too tired to trust his memory, Stranahan had jotted the tag number on the inside of his wrist.
15 more minutes, she said. Then we can go.
Thank you. Earlier, after leaving the car rental agency, they had, over Stranahan's objections, stopped at an outlet mall. Joey had decided that she couldn't continue wearing the clothes of his ex-wives and girlfriends, and noted as an example that their bras were all too large. Grimly, Stranahan had trailed after her as she accumulated $2,400 worth of slacks, tops, skirts, shoes, cosmetics, and other personal items. She was the most ruthless and efficient shopper that he'd ever seen, but the experience had exhausted him so thoroughly that his senses now seemed cauterized. Or perhaps that's how everyone came to feel in West Boca Dunes, Phase 2.
You didn't even ask about the black dress, Joey was saying. There's quite a naughty history there.
I was letting my imagination run wild. Whatever he's doing with her tonight, he's thinking about me. That I can guarantee. And wait till he finds the lipstick. Stranahan leaned his head against the window and shut his eyes.
Don't you dare go to sleep, Joey said.
I miss my dog. I want to go back to the island.
She poked him in the shoulder. There they are.
Two figures emerged from the Perrone house, a man and a woman, hurrying down the walkway. In the darkness, Stranahan couldn't make out their faces, but undoubtedly it was Joey's husband and his guest. As they got into the blue Ford, their expressions were briefly illuminated by the dome light. Both of them appeared soberly preoccupied, and not exactly radiating the afterglow of love.
Joey said, "He's driving. You know what that means."
"No, what?"
"He's been doing her," she said.
"Guys never ask to drive your car until after they've slept with you at least twice. That's what Rose says, and she's been with, like, 49 men. Sounds like it's time for an oil change."
"Hey, let's follow him," Joey said.
"Let's not. Let's assume he screwed her and he's taking her to dinner, and then he's sending her on her way."
"I'm going back inside my house."
"Bad idea," Stranahan said.
"You've creeped him out enough for one night. Give me 10 minutes. I've got to use the bathroom."
Joey hopped out of the Suburban and jogged down the street. When she returned, "Move It On Over" was blasting from the speakers. She frowned at Stranahan.
"That's cold."
"It's not the CD, it's the radio." He twisted the volume down. "I lucked into classic rock."
"What's so funny?"
"At my age, I'm a sucker for ironies. Buckle up." Joey didn't speak again until they were southbound on the interstate. Chaz definitely noticed the dress in the closet because it was gone when I went back.
"Excellent.
But I found something really weird in the sink."
"What?"
Stranahan was thinking maybe Jell-O or whipped cream.
"Pubic hair," Joey reported indignantly. "Kelly Green pubic hair. That nasty woman shaved herself all over my vanity."
Mick Stranahan reached over and squeezed her hand. Nobody said this was going to be easy. The man called Tool lived in a trailer outside of LaBelle, not far from Lake Okeechobee. The trailer had come with a half-acre parcel upon which the previous owner had cultivated tomatoes, a crop despised by Tool since his days as a crew boss. The day he moved in, he hitched an old Pontiac engine block to his truck and dragged it back and forth across the tomato patch until all that remained was churned dirt. In place of vegetables, Tool began planting highway fatality markers that he collected on his travels throughout southwest Florida. The small, homemade crosses often displayed colorful floral arrangements, which Tool found pleasing to the eye. Whenever he spied one of the markers along a road, he would yank it from the ground and place it in the back of his truck. Often this act was witnessed by other motorists, though nobody ever attempted to interfere. Tool stood 6'3" and weighed 280 pounds and owned a head like a cinder block. His upper body was matted so heavily with hair that he perspired copiously, even in cold weather, and found it uncomfortable to wear a shirt. Nearly a year had passed since Toole had been shot in broad daylight by a poacher who had mistaken him for a bear. No entry wound had been visible, as the slug had uncannily tunneled into the seam of Toole's formidable buttocks. Because bleeding was minimal, he elected to forego medical treatment, a decision that would come back to haunt him. Soon the pain became so unbearable that he gave up his job as a crew boss, no longer physically able to harass and abuse migrant farm workers for 12 hours at a stretch. Such was his misery that a concerned dope addict friend recommended fentanyl, a high-octane painkiller used during surgery, but also available in a convenient skin patch. Toole had no prescription for the medicine, but he did have a lockpick. Once a week, he'd drive to Fort Myers, break into a nursing home, and meticulously peel the fentanyl patches from torsos of sedated cancer patients. In no time, Toole was hopelessly hooked, his dosage escalating to levels that would have euthanized a more highly evolved organism. The only serious obstacle to his drug habit was his excess of body hair, so dense and oily as to defy conventional adhesives. Daily cropping was required, often in checkerboard patterns to accommodate multiple stolen patches. That was how Red Hammernut found him, buck naked in a rusty washtub behind the house trailer, scraping brutally at his shoulder blades with a disposable razor.
"Hey," Toole said, "long time no see."
"I've been to Africa after them tarpon."
With a groggy sigh, Red Hammernut lowered himself into a tattered lawn chair.
"Just got back to Tampa this morning, and I'm jet-lagged out of my skull. May I ask what in the name of Jesus P. Christ you're doing?"
"You got a job for me?"
That was one thing Red Hammernut admired about Toole. The sumbitch got right to the point.
"Go on and finish your bath. We'll talk after," Red said. "Meantime, where's my old friend, Mr. Daniel?"
"There's a bottle in the bedroom somewhere."
Toole's bedroom was the last place that Red Hammernut yearned to explore, so he took a beer from the refrigerator instead. When he came back outside, Toole was hosing himself off. Red pointed at the field of white fatality markers behind the trailer.
"How many you got now?"
60-odd, maybe 70.
Toole shook himself like a drenched buffalo.
"Say, Red, throw me that damn towel."
It was a wadded scrap, stained with what appeared to be transmission fluid. Red Hammernut tossed it to Toole, who fashioned a do-rag crookedly around his head.
"I still can't understand why you save these damn things. It's pretty fucking depressing, you ask me," Red said.
Toole turned to contemplate the orderly rows of crosses. He didn't give a shit about the car crash victims, but he liked the visual symmetry of his design.
"It's sort of like that famous soldier graveyard up in Washington. What's it called?"
"Arlington?"
"Yeah. Sort of like a mini Arlington."
"Christ, I'm sure."
"Well, it's better than goddamn tomatoes."
"You're right about that,"
Red Hammernut laughed. The two had met 4 years earlier, when Red Hammernut's company purchased the vegetable farm where Toole was running crews of pickers and packers. After observing Toole's specialized management techniques, Red had recruited him for side jobs that required muscle and a lack of conscience. Red had found him to be reliable and focused in the way of a natural predator, though not as ruthlessly gung-ho as his predecessor, Crow Beecham. It was Crow who had eagerly volunteered to dispose of that foolish young Mexican, the one griping about the curdled toilets and brown-running water at the migrant camps. Barely 19, the boy had marched his complaint to the faggot communist lawyers and rural legal services, who were preparing to share it with a federal judge when their star witness vanished. It was almost 2 years before they'd found the Mexican kid's skeleton in a phosphate pit 100 miles away, but by then Crow Beecham was dead from syphilis and tapeworms. Toole took better care of himself, Red Hammernut noted, though not much.
"What's the work?" Toole asked. "And how much does it pay?"
$500 a day.
Toole looked amazed and doubtful.
Do I gotta kill somebody or something?
I doubt it.
Don't be jerking me around, Red. I ain't in the mood. Not with a bullet in the crack of my ass.
He lumbered indoors and banged about for a few minutes. He emerged wearing black denim overalls and carrying a pizza that was frozen solid. When he took a bite, it sounded like the crack of a .22. Red Hammernut decided not to ask about the three flesh-colored patches that Tool had attached to the shaven areas on his back. The less known about the man's personal habits, the better.
Let's have it,
Tool said.
Okay, here's the deal. I got a boy that does some work for me. He lost his wife a few days back. He's a little shaky right now, and I need you to keep an eye on him.
How'd she die?
Blood was trickling out of Tool's mouth from where the pizza crust had lacerated his gums.
She fell off one of them cruise liners out in the ocean.
No shit. Was she some kind of retard or something?
Not hardly.
From experience, Red Hammernut knew it was best not to clutter Tool's brain with a surplus of information.
Anyway, the boy's nerves are about fried on account of her being lost at sea and the cops asking questions and so forth. This morning I get a message on my machine. Now he thinks somebody's sneaking into his house and moving shit around and generally trying to freak his ass out. Personally, I got a feeling it's all in his head. Either way, he needs a guardian angel, and that would be you.
Tool nodded, chewing savagely.
You say he works on the farm?
Red Hammernut raised his arm in time to deflect an errant chunk of pepperoni.
Nope, he lives over in Boca Raton.
Oh, fuck, Red.
I know, it's horrible. That's how come to 500 a day.
Tool spat again, this time intentionally, and stomped back into the trailer. He came out with a bag of beef jerky sticks.
Give me one of them bad boys,
Red Hammernut said, helping himself.
Boca! I swear to God, Red.
I'm really sorry, man.
What kind of work he'd do for you, this guy?
Nothing I want advertised, understand? You notice any funny business, I expect you to call me.
Sure thing,
said Tool.
And don't hurt nobody, Red Hammernut said. Lest I say so.
Once, when the feds were investigating potentially damaging, though well-founded, accusations that Red was holding farm laborers as indentured slaves, he sent Tool to discourage the aggrieved workers from cooperating with the authorities. While nobody disappeared or died, the few workers who dared to testify unanimously portrayed Mr. Hammernut as a saintly, paternal figure who plucked them from a life of aimless destitution and given them a bright future in modern agriculture. Based on what he'd seen in the labor camps of Immokalee and Belglade, Red felt confident that Tool would have no trouble handling a weak, pampered white boy like Chaz Perrone. With a grunt, Red stretched his arms and announced he was going home to sleep for about 4 days. Tool followed him out to the paved road where the gray Cadillac waited. As usual, Red's driver had kept the engine running and the thermostat set at 68 degrees.
She a pretty girl?
Tool asked.
Who? The wife? Yeah, she was.
Tool scratched at his neck.
Maybe he killed her.
I don't care, said Red Hammernut, and neither do you.
9. One spring evening in 1896, a prominent Pennsylvanian named Hamilton Diston blew his brains out in a bathtub. He had become gravely depressed after depleting his inheritance on a grandiose campaign to drain 4 million acres of Florida swamp known as the Everglades. Although Diston died believing himself a failure, he was later proven a pioneer and an inspiration. In the years that followed, one version or another of his rapacious fantasy was pursued by legions of avaricious speculators. Land developers, bankers, railroad barons, real estate promoters, citrus growers, cattle ranchers, sugar tycoons, and, last but not least, the politicians they owned. Those wetlands that could not be dried, paved, or planted
were eventually trenched out and diked into vast reservoirs by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Billions of gallons of fresh water that for eons had flowed freely as a broad, marshy river toward Florida Bay was now held captive for siphoning by agriculture, industry, and burgeoning municipalities. First one cross-state highway and then another transected the southern thumb of the peninsula, fatally interrupting the remaining southbound trickle from Lake Okeechobee. What precious water made it to the heart of the marsh often arrived tainted by pesticides, fertilizers, and mercury. To protect farms and subdivisions from frequent flooding, the unsurprising consequence of having occupied a bog, hundreds of miles of canals were dug to carry the overflow out to sea during the rainy summer months. Engineers employed a string of pumping stations to manipulate the water levels according to whim and weather, heedless of the historic natural cycles. Inevitably, the Everglades and all its resplendent wildlife began to die, but nobody with the power to prevent it considered trying. It was, after all, just a huge damn swamp. Toward the latter part of the 20th century, a series of severe droughts shattered the cocksure assumption that there would always be plenty of water to steal. Those whose fortunes depended on luring homebuyers and tourists to South Florida now contemplated the dreadful possibility that the infernal granola head environmentalists had been correct all along. If the Everglades dried up or succumbed to pollution, so might the vast underground aquifer that supplied drinking water from Palm Beach to the Keys. Growth would come to a gagging halt, and the dirty fortunes that accompanied it would evaporate faster than jizz on a griddle. This apocalyptic scenario was laid out before Florida's politicians, and in time even the most slatternly among them were extolling the Everglades as a national treasure that must be preserved at all costs. Office holders who had for decades abetted its destruction now delivered quavering oratory lamenting its demise. During election campaigns, they shamelessly contrived to be photographed kayaking around the East Cape or hiking Shark Valley, drowsy alligators and snowy egrets prominent in the background. Saving the Everglades became an apple pie cause embraced by both political parties, and voters responded avidly. Sadly, there wasn't much left to save. 90% of the original glades already had been developed, converted to agriculture, or otherwise debauched. The only untrampled remnant was a national park, the waters of which were of dubious purity. Nonetheless, in the late 1990s, the United States Congress and the Florida legislature allotted a boggling $8 billion to restore a natural and unpolluted flow to the fabled River of Grass. Many decent and well-meaning people believe this to be a moral imperative. Then there were those such as Samuel Johnson Hammernut, whose sole interest in sustaining the Everglades was to make sure that his 13,000 acres of lettuce, cabbage, sweet corn, tomatoes, radishes, escarole, and parsley would have cheap and unlimited irrigation forever. Red Hammernut cared only slightly less about the imperiled wildlife than he did about the wretched souls who toiled for dirt wages in his crop fields, held captive to his employment with imaginary debts imposed by violent crew bosses. As for the pollution issue, Red Hammernut intended to continue using the vast marshlands as a latrine, and to hell with the law. A pragmatic fellow, he'd watched closely as the bureaucracy of the Everglades Restoration Project evolved, and he had taken measures to safeguard his stake. $8 billion was an unholy shitload of dough, and Red Hammernut calculated that no less than a third of it would be ripped off by lobbyists, lawyers, consultants, and bid riggers favored by well-placed politicians. The remaining windfall would be spent more or less earnestly, if not efficiently, by a phalanx of municipal, state, and federal agencies that would seldom communicate with one another. Prominent among these was the South Florida Water Management District, which was recruiting field biologists to test for harmful substances in farm runoff. It was a specialized mission, one that held some potential to complicate Red Hammernut's life. Conveniently, the members of the Water Board had been appointed by the governor, to whose re-election campaign Red Hammernut had donated large sums of money and the use of a Cessna citation. Therefore, it was no surprise to Red Herrenut that his phone call to the water board was so genially received, or that his recommendation of a bright young job applicant was so promptly acted upon. After that, it was easy arranging for the newly hired biologist to be assigned to the same water testing district in which certain large vegetable farms were located. On paper, Dr. Charles R. Perrone looked like the real deal. Red Herrenut had his mole in place.
"It's good to see you're staying busy," Carl Rolvag said.
Chaz Perrone nodded stoically.
"Your supervisor said she told you to take the whole week off, even longer if you needed."
Chaz frowned. "You spoke to Marta? What for?"
"Just routine," said the detective. "Anyway, she said you insisted on coming back to work, and I told her it could actually be a healthy thing."
"Well, what else am I supposed to do? Hang around the house all day and get morbidly depressed? No, thank you."
They were standing in the kitchen, Chaz with a Budweiser in his hand, and Rolvag sipping a Sprite. The detective had shown up at the front door not 5 minutes after Chaz had returned from work.
"I'm really beat," Chaz said for the third time.
"Yeah, it was a scorcher out there today." Rolvag had seen on the news that an early spring snowstorm had hit the Twin Cities. He sitting in air conditioning in Florida. It was fairly astounding.
He said, "Marta explained what you do on your job, and it sounds real interesting. I bet you run into plenty of snakes out there."
"Well, I run over plenty of them with my truck," Chaz, unable to resist the smart-ass quip.
"Look, I'm not trying to be rude, but man, I am seriously whipped."
"Of course, I understand." The detective finished off the soda and raised the empty bottle.
"Do you recycle?"
Chaz made a dunking motion toward the trash can.
"Let God sort them out," he said.
Rolvag placed the bottle on the counter.
"There was just one point I needed you to clarify about that night on the Sun Duchess."
"You know who you remind me of? That TV cop, Columbo. He never quit with the questions," Chaz said. "I bet that was your favorite show, am I right?"
"To be honest, I never watched it."
"But I'm sure other people must have told you the same thing, that you remind them of Columbo. Not the way you look, but how you never let up.
In a nice way, though."
Rolvag said, "What night is the show on? I'd like to see it." Chaz shook his head.
"What a hopeless dweeb. It was canceled like 100 years ago. Anyway, what did you want to ask me about?"
The detective seemed relieved to get back to business.
"Just one thing, really. Are you certain about what time Mrs. Perrone left the stateroom?"
Chaz experienced a disconcerting twitch in his colon.
3:30 in the morning, like I told you before. I remember looking at my watch."
"And there's no chance your watch was wrong?"